people move from more conservative, more fundamentalist, to more liberal, less fundamentalist. They, you know, not many people will go as far as I did. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll move from a, you know, fundamentalist Christianity to liberal Christianity, and I'm really happy that they do that because they're better people in that mindset than they were before.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, another mind freed from the shackles of religious dogma, exploring the no true Christian fallacy, and a former apologist who realized that his best arguments for Christianity weren't so good after all. All coming up on this week's episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm your host for this week. I really enjoy speaking with former believers. The more passionate they were about their belief, the more interesting they are, I think. Because I think that's where real humility could be found, in believers who were so passionate about their beliefs, and then completely change their whole worldview and talk about how they were so wrong in the past. To me, that is what ultimate humility is. The person we're going to be speaking with on this week's episode is Jason Eden, and he is a contributor to The Humanist magazine, and you could find some of his articles online at thehumanist.com. I'd like to read for you just an excerpt of his initial article that he wrote on May 13th of this year of 2014. Lots of people lose their religious faith and keep quiet about it. They have great reasons for doing so. Entire communities and family relationships are built on agreement that God is real. Publicly express doubt, and you risk becoming an outcast in both social and family circles. Thus, many people go through the motions. What's the harm in believing a beautiful lie? The problem for me was that the lie's not harmless. Scratch the surface, and you quickly expose a dark underbelly of rules designed to keep people in bondage. Women are to be submissive to men. Gay relationships are abominations. Natural sexual urges are sinful. This life is relatively meaningless compared to the afterlife. Suffering is purposeful and justified, and so on. This system of beliefs is not only harmful, but, pushed to extremes, can result in devastation on a societal scale. Truth matters after all. And if you want the rest of the article, you do have to go to thehumanist.com and just search for his name and you'll find it there. And again, that was written by Jason Eden, who is a former Southern Baptist preacher, youth minister, worship leader, and Christian apologist. Now a humanist celebrant, he resides near St. Louis, Missouri, with his wife and two children. He wrote about his journey away from faith and his coming out in the book, That's Me in the Corner, Coming Out as an Atheist on Facebook. Professionally, he works in corporate education capacities in the fields of big data and cloud computing, and sometimes guest blogs at thebookofwonder.org and other places of interest. Once again, as with the rest of our guests, if you just Google their name, you're going to find them all over the place. And Jason Eden is no different. So here we go, my interview with Jason Eden about coming out as an atheist on Facebook. I have the great pleasure of speaking with Mr. Jason Eden. How are you, Jason?
Doing well, Bo. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Oh, can we begin by perhaps you giving our listeners a condensed version of your journey to non-religion?
Absolutely. So anyone who's read my story on thehumanist.com or perhaps read through my book, you know, I grew up in a small rural Southern Baptist family, deeply religious, was very active in religious activities as a teenager, intended to go into bivocational ministry roles, and in fact, you know, after graduating college, normally worked a regular job, but also was very active in church, doing part-time youth ministry work and that kind of thing. Also did some youth ministry work in college. And typically in your more fundamentalist, Bible-believing type churches, although by the time I graduated college, I had left the Southern Baptist denomination behind and had joined what was called the seeker-sensitive movement.
Mm-hmm.
Did that for a number of years, was always very active in apologetics, and enjoyed honest conversations and debates with skeptics and non-believers and people of different faiths and what have you, and always trying to hone and make sure that my beliefs lined up with what could be objectively shown to be true. And through about, you know, the mid-90s, late-90s, early 2000s, the philosophical tenets on which I based my beliefs could pretty much hold up with all of the other belief systems based on my exposure to the data. In mid-2000s, my son, who's now 10 years old and doing wonderfully, but in the mid-2000s, he was diagnosed with autism. And so for the next 6 years, that completely engulfed my life. You know, other than work, I was spending every effort that I had to help him along his way to recovery. And like I said, happy story. It's an amazing, amazing journey, on its own merit. I was really out of the picture of, you know, the science debates and, as the internet was starting to explode and what have you, I was really focused on that and not really paying attention to the world around me, if you will.
Mm.
Once we got him going, I started to re-engage in, you know, the science, started to get back into church activities as well. And what I found out was, is that the philosophical underpinnings on which my apologetics had been based on had turned out to be wrong. And so faced with this dilemma, this crisis of faith, if you will, because, you know, the God that I had claimed would be there and what we would find based on his existence wasn't there, I went to my church, asked for help. Once they saw the evidence, rather than saying, let's discuss this, they were really along the lines of, we're really not going to have this conversation with you. And it was really just a few short months later that I finally, you know, admitted to myself that based on this underpinning being removed, I really had no reason to continue to believe in the supernatural anymore, and started to deal with that.
Hmm. So it sounds like your actual journey wasn't that long from faithful to non-religion. It sounds, how much time do you think was in that zone?
Yeah, so I had, as a believer, had struggled with my faith multiple times. And I think even most believers would admit that they all have times of doubt or what have you.
Sure.
But the actual time period for what I would call deconversion, it was actually really short, because there were, you know, these underpinnings that had really been the cornerstone of my faith. Things like the Kalam's cosmological argument, and, you know, conservation of energy and how all that worked. Things like what we would find in the fossil record and things we would find in, you know, genetic differences between humans and other, you know, supposed close relatives on this planet. And I had, with full confidence, made all kinds of predictions about what we would find in the sciences based on, you know, if God is real, then this must be true. And if two out of the three had fallen, but one out of the three had held up, I probably would still have had enough reason to hold on. But when all three of those fell, the intellectual part of my deconversion actually happened fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. The emotional part probably took a year and a half, 2 years.
Okay. Well, that's interesting that you separate the rational and the emotional. I've never heard anybody do that, but that's completely true how that actually works.
Very much so.
Well, good for you for actually looking at the rational and saying, well, I can't believe this anymore, because many people, as you know, if the whole rational part of it falls apart, they just close their eyes, plug their ears, and say, I don't care, I believe, because that's what I need to do.
Absolutely. For most people, when they get back into the corner where the facts really point in the opposite direction of what they choose to believe. They default to what they define as faith. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I personally still believe I have faith, you know, but I define it the way I defined it even as a believer, which is, you know, I take a look at the best available evidence and then take the next logical step. For other people, faith is actually, you know, having beliefs even in the face of evidence against them.
Right.
And that's, you know, when I would have labeled myself a Christian, I never would have claimed that mantle of faith.
Hmm. Okay. So you were what they call a rational Christian.
I very much tried to be.
Yeah.
And I actually had many people along the way in my journey say, "You really don't sound like a Christian."
Huh.
And, you know, I was talking and they would mean it as a compliment.
Right. Right, sure. Now, I'm sure you've heard the argument before that if you were ever a true Christian, you would have never have left. Now, looking back, could you have possibly been just faking your Christianity the whole time?
Well, it depends on how you're going to define what being a true Christian means. What I find interesting is that when they talk to kids in vacation Bible schools or when they're talking to people and doing street witnessing, Christianity is actually a very simple equation. You know, believe in your heart the Lord Jesus, confess your sins, and accept him as your Lord and Savior. Boom, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
By that definition, I was absolutely a Christian. In fact, I was more serious about Christianity than probably 90%+ of people who would cast aspersions on my own faith.
Hmm. You know, I would take that as a complete insult if somebody told me, if I spent my whole life practicing Christianity and preaching and doing the things that you did, and somebody told me that I wasn't a true Christian, I would be pretty upset and offended. But, you know, most of the people who use that whole line, they're never a true Christian, what they really mean is that they converted. So by their definition, anybody who converts from Christianity was never a true Christian. And we could use that same line in atheism. We could say, well, no. You were never a true atheist if you're now a Christian. I say, no, I was an atheist. I didn't believe in God. And no, sorry. You weren't a true atheist because you're now a Christian. You were just a Christian who didn't quite know it yet.
Yeah. There's in that definition, there's really no way to know. And that's when I get those discussions from my believing friends, I'll often point back and say, well, then how do you know, how do you know that you're a Christian? And any replies that they give back are things that I absolutely would have said as a believer.
Exactly.
So, like I said, there's no way to know until you die. By that definition.
Right, of course. And because nobody knows the future, so nobody knows, no matter how committed you are at the time, that your views or your opinions and your beliefs will change in the future. You just don't know. And if you claim to know, you are a liar.
Exactly.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with former Christian apologist Jason Eden. All right. So as an apologist, you weren't just a preacher, you were an apologist. What are some of the best arguments that you would use against heathens such as myself?
Well, the first thing I would do would be to try to build a relationship by not calling you a heathen.
Okay.
But where it all started was the existence. Again, the cosmological argument, everything in the universe, is a caused thing. It was caused by something else. Mm-hmm. Even if you accept all the science around the Big Bang and whatever, there was still that question of what caused the Big Bang. And assuming that there were, the law of conservation of energy was absolute and could never be violated, then you could not explain how the matter of the universe just appeared out of nothing. And I would just take that as the next logical step and say, hey, well, if we can't explain, if energy is constant in the universe, then something had to have, you know, kicked it off, if nothing else. And I would just try to get, you know, particularly atheists,
mm-hmm.
to really look at their underlying assumptions about, you know, explaining how anything exists at all. And, you know, and I would make, with full honesty, you know, I wasn't trying to dig at people, but I would say, hey, look, you know, you believe it came from nothing. I'm looking at the science and saying that that's impossible. So your faith actually, you know, is greater than mine in this particular instance. And it was, again, not intended as a dig. I know some people use that that way. But I was legitimate and serious when I said that. Mm-hmm. And then, it was funny, in a discussion with an agnostic friend of mine, he basically said, well, but, I mean, so what would it take to prove, you know, for you to challenge that belief, which is a question that I often pose to him myself. So it was a fair response. And I thought about it and I said, well, I suppose if, you know, if we observed empty space and found, you know, matter just kind of popped in and out of existence, you know, right, on some kind of random basis, then maybe that would be, you know, enough for me to question that core belief. And then, like, 2 weeks later, I discovered my first article on virtual particles.
Sure.
and the rest is history.
It's like, okay, all right. Okay, so the Kalam cosmological argument that states basically everything that has a beginning, or everything that began has a beginning, or something along those lines.
So, yeah, everything that exists has a cause.
Has a cause, okay.
And, you know, and then you have to go back in time and say, you know, and the supernatural explanation was, you know, there must be an uncaused cause in order for anything else that is caused to exist. But like I said, you know, the modern science has completely, you know, stripped that argument of any real scientific validity, because, you know, we see little pieces of matter and antimatter popping in and out of existence all around us. And in fact, we're looking at using this phenomenon to power, like, space rockets and stuff. Mm. I mean, it's really the universe is a strange place.
Right. Yeah. All right. So what about another argument? You said you had three pillars of arguments.
Yeah.
What was the other
one? So the other two, one was fossil records.
Okay.
So back when I was heavily involved in the discussions, any kind of you know, major advances in discoveries as far as fossils were concerned, really were discoveries of new species, and we hadn't really uncovered a lot of fossils of transitionary species. So, you know, the fossils that show that dinosaurs go from, you know, large behemoths to, you know, little things with wings that fly around us all the time.
Right. Jason, let me interrupt you. Were you a creationist? Did you consider yourself a creationist?
I did, very much so.
And a young Earth creationist?
For a while, yeah. Even though as an older Earth creationist, I still kind of took a view where God would step in from time to time and either, you know, do the whole theistic evolution approach where he nudged evolution, or, and actually I thought the fossil records would show that there were just complete additional creation experiences that really defied explanation.
Okay.
And so, you know, and at the time it was great. Because, you know, there was no, I mean, you have to remember, I mean, late 90s, early 2000s, the internet was this new thing, and, you know, people were still trying to figure out how to get stuff on there. It wasn't easy to find. It wasn't wasn't anything like the experience we have today. And so as these fossils, over the last 10, 12 years really have started to just be discovered all over the place. Not only, you know, early human fossils, but transitionary fossils that show, you know, specific delineations between dinosaurs and birds, and between fish and then creatures that walked on land, and all this kind of fun stuff. You know, that my argument of you can't explain the fossil records without a creator absolutely disappeared.
Yeah.
And then the third kind of argument that I made was the genetics argument. So again, you know, it's been theorized since, you know, Darwin that we were probably closely related to you know, apes or what have you. And Christians and myself included rejected that hypothesis. And so I went as far as to say that when we got to mapping the human genome, and my wife, ironically, did an internship one summer where she was actually part of that project where we were mapping the human genome at a college in Norman, Oklahoma. When we actually got the human genome mapped and started comparing our genetic code to, other creatures like chimpanzees and bonobos, we would find these differences that you just really couldn't explain via some kind of natural evolutionary process. Because I believed in a designer. I believed there were these things that you couldn't explain without pushing a button or nudging something in a direction, and that it'd be pretty stark differences. Mm-hmm. The evidence, when I went back and examined what they had found, was that, genetically we're somewhere between 96 and 99% identical to chimpanzees and bonobos. It blew that argument completely out of the water. All three of my pillars had fallen.
Hmm. Did you ever think at the time that you might be guilty of the God of the Gaps argument?
Oh, yeah. I actually embraced that because my thinking was different, I think, than a lot of people have when they use those arguments. I was, again, taking faith as take a look at the best available evidence and then take the next logical step.
Okay.
And again, particularly with the cosmological argument, without any kind of evidence that matter can violate, even on a very tiny scale, the conservation of energy, then if there's no evidence to support that, then the next logical step is something outside the universe had to have caused it. When that evidence appears, you're gone. But my God of the Gaps was really, I tried to approach it like a CSI investigator with a crime scene where you have fingerprints, you have a murder weapon. You didn't actually see the guy pull the trigger, but, you're taking the evidence and doing the next logical step. My approach didn't change. The evidence did.
Right. Okay. All right, you talked a little bit before about the conversion process, and you said it was, well, it depends on whether you're talking rationally or emotionally, how long it actually took. But during this time, did you spend any time as like a generic theist or a deist believing in like an inactive God? Or did you go straight from Christianity to nothing?
Yeah, no. I actually, in my book, I detail the kind of phase and journey. So, once you get to the point where you can start questioning things like the Bible, you start critically analyzing some of the passages and moral stances and some of this kind of fun stuff, I really started to take a step back, starting with one of the safer targets, because, Jesus was untouchable, but Paul was just another guy. Mm-hmm. And so started off by rejecting some of his stuff and then the Old Testament. And there are a lot of Christians, I think, who have actually just landed at this phase where what they end up believing in are this tiny fraction of their scriptures, which is the Ten Commandments and the red words, is what they would say. Right. Unfortunately, the red words have problems as well. And for people who aren't familiar with what I mean by red words, that in some versions of the Bible, they actually print the words of Jesus in red. And so that's why, they hold those in higher esteem. Mm-hmm. But no, I definitely went through, phases where I was, I'm still, I just don't believe the Bible is inerrant. And then I was like, so I'm not really a Christian, but I still believe in God and this whole idea of his love and all this kind of thing. And then what I, in my book, I called a slightly spiritual deist, which is actually a contradiction in terms, where I kind of thought that God might have intervened at key moments in history. Finally just admitted, look, you can explain everything without a God. Why do I feel it necessary to keep adding him back in?
Hmm. Hmm. Did you get to the point where you did think that no explanation or a simple I don't know is more reasonable than positing like an all miraculous magical God?
Yeah, I'd say I'm there today, right? I mean, when I say I still have faith, it's it's funny, my definition of faith really has never changed, and neither has the way I apply a definition of faith. But, you know, we look at the world around us, and I said, you know, virtual particles don't necessarily explain the existence of the universe in and of themselves, right? They show us a hint of, you know, the laws of the universe as we think they exist might not be as, you know, hard-coded as we thought they were. In classical terms. I don't know how the universe came into existence. And frankly, I don't know that there isn't some supernatural thing involved as far as getting everything kicked off. All I know is that it's not necessary to invoke supernatural in order to, you know, show these hints and proofs. And so I still have, you know, a faith of a sort where I like, hey, you know, there are naturalist explanations for this. And if naturalist explanations exist, that at least, you know, are logical and line up with the evidence, then, you know, I don't know what the specifics and particulars are, and I'm very comfortable, you know, not knowing, and I no longer have to invoke supernatural.
Hmm. All right. That's interesting. So let's talk about your congregation for a moment. You were a preacher, so does that mean you had a congregation? I'm not sure of the terminology here, if I'm using it correctly.
Yeah, so I had several roles in different churches. I was never a formal pastor of a church, like over the entire congregation. I was a youth pastor in a couple of different settings.
Okay.
As well as worship leaders, or, you know, member of a larger worship team, or things like that. But I did a lot of, especially in my teens and early 20s, I did a lot of little, like, weekend youth revivals and things like that, sponsored through my college and then in local churches growing up.
Gotcha. Okay. So we can't call them your congregation. Let's call them your peeps.
Yes. my peeps. That'll work.
All right. Did your peeps witness you evolve from a fundamentalist preacher to an atheist, or was the transition more abrupt from their perspective?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, when I was a teenager and first started, I first started preaching before I could drive. So, you know, my theology and views of the world or whatever were fairly simplistic way back then.
Right.
But I was always a little different than, you know, most of the kids in my youth group. For one, I took the whole religion thing seriously. But the other thing was, I was very much one who questioned. I didn't accept what people, you know, just told me as truth. I mean, the whole, you know, Graham Southern Baptist, you know, and hearing him try to defend their anti-alcohol stance as Jesus served grape juice at a wedding party. I just, you know, even as a kid, I never bought that.
Right.
You know, I think my transition points were such that the people growing up with me, you know, they probably didn't see much of a change, but then I went to college, and the people in college maybe didn't see much of a change, but then we, you know, we moved to Kansas City, and I got my first job and was in a youth group there. Now, I was a very different youth pastor at that church than I had been when I was a youth pastor during my college years. But, you know, again, I don't think that anyone in that group would have identified a transition. And my life over the last, you know, 20 years has been a series of, you know, living in one place for, you know, 2 to 4 years, and then, you know, moving to another one and then moving to another one. So, I really don't think, most people would have seen a transition as far as them being surrounded by me. Now, in the context of online media, I did have people who started to notice the tone of my posts were changing.
Hmm.
And, you know, probably about 4 or 6 months before the actual, you know, my admission to myself that I was really an atheist, I did have people who were saying, hey, are you losing your way? Are you all right? And, you know, I came out and came back and said, no, I'm asking open questions and have complete faith that, you know, God is going to answer them and it's going to be all good. So I think on my social media peeps, those people probably saw a transition happening. But as far as, like, you know, any church that I was involved in and whatever, it probably seemed, you know, like I was pretty much the same from beginning to end.
Yeah, that's funny that you mentioned that whole changing tone. I've seen that so many times with so many people over, I don't know, the last 4 years of just being in social media, being involved in online debate, and just talking with people over time and seeing how their views actually change and the frequency of their posts, the tone of their posts. You could tell that what they once believed isn't quite where they are, but that's to be expected. I think everybody changes. But, you know, I could honestly say, and I know there are many Christians that would be quick to pull out an example that contradicts what I'm about to say, but I could honestly say that the vast majority of people tend to become more liberal or more non-theistic over time in these debates and not the other way around. Do you tend to agree with that?
Well, absolutely. And again, I'm a prime example, but I have also connected to a group called the Clergy Project, which is a group of ministers, some of them still actively filling pulpits on a weekly basis or what have you, who have, as they've investigated evidence and truth, have fallen away and you know, walked away from their faith. Which is, I just can't imagine how terrible that would be, being a pastor and being in that situation. I mean, you occasionally see it in the other direction, but, you know, vast majority of the time, people move from more conservative, more fundamentalist, to more liberal, less fundamentalist. They, you know, not many people will go as far as I did. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll move from a, you know, fundamentalist Christianity to liberal Christianity, and I'm really happy that they do that, because they're better people in that mindset than they were before. But you very seldom see it go the other direction, because frankly, if you're someone who's engaging in the debates and you're looking at facts and you're looking at evidence and you're actually honestly trying to find what's really true, everything's going to point in a certain direction. So it doesn't surprise me that really most people tend to move the same direction that I did.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with former Christian apologist Jason Eden. And it is that whole process of gathering evidence and listening to other opinions, having an open mind, that tends to bring you in a more liberal direction. Whereas I think when people go in the other direction, when people go from atheistic or really not caring about religion to completely fundamentalist, it's almost always one of those experiences, like they're at the end of their rope and they're about to commit suicide, and at the very last minute they decide to make changes, and then of course they credit God, or they check themselves into some kind of religious center where they get the help they need, and it's attributed to Jesus, and boom, they're Christians. It's that instant, like almost overnight type of conversion, whereas the deconversion process can take years for most people.
Yeah, and the instances that I've seen of people moving the other direction, a lot of it has actually been what I would call a survival mechanism, more so than a natural conclusion to their journey. With people who ask questions, start to become ostracized, you know, family and friends and sometimes spouses, you know, and parents and what have you, start to panic, and you know, and you realize suddenly that, you know, your entire world is at stake here. And so, you know, if you think of the book 1984 and the whole concept of doublethink, there are people who know that what they actively and honestly, legitimately believe is not true. And yet they live and behave and defend it as though it is, because the cost of not doing so for them is their lives. You know, maybe not their breathing lives, but it's their, you know, family and friends and everything that they know. And so they would rather just switch off their brains and quit this silly journey for truth, and instead, you know, live happily ever after with everyone. And that's just the way that they have to do it, is by just going full on fundamentalist and who gives a crap about reality.
Right. Now, one of the other reasons that people do not give up their religion so quickly is their previous investment in the religion. Did you see any of that? Did you have that feeling that, oh, geez, you know, since 15 or age 12, I invested my entire life in this whole God thing, and I've invested so much time into it, and now, you know, what if it's not true? What am I going to do, or what did I do? I wasted all my time. Did you have those thoughts, and how did you manage to get through that?
Well, I'd say my biggest problem was, man, I hate having to admit that I'm wrong. I really, really, really don't like I love being shown that I'm wrong, but I hate to have to, you know, fess up to it. So, and I think that's probably, you know, I don't think I'm alone in that. And so, you know, I personally always approached my journey from a standpoint of, you know, this is a search for truth, and I'm happy to change my opinions. And I think that self-conditioning probably alleviated a lot of that kind of remorse for me. I can definitely understand where people would get that. But for me, you know, I wasn't so much invested in, oh, I've wasted 20 years of my life, as, hey, if I'm wrong about this, I want to make sure that, you know, my kids and their kids don't, you know, invest 20 years of their life following the same fallacies that I did.
Yeah, it's a good perspective to have on that. You spoke earlier about your son with autism. How did that affect your spiritual journey?
Yeah, that's a good question. So interestingly, the first thing that having a son with autism did to me wasn't necessarily a spiritual part of my journey, but the political side of my journey. Mm-hmm. So as a believer in you know, your typical conservative fundamentalist background or what have you, I was very much of two minds. Number one, you know, people should take care of themselves you know, handle their own problems and this, that, and the other. And two, you know, we didn't need assistance, what have you, because God and God's people could and would step in and take care of whatever needs, you know, you might have if they were beyond your control. Having a child with autism at the time that we had the child was a direct affront to both of those worldviews. Because A, there's nothing the church could or would have done with regards to my son's therapy and the massive costs involved in the first 3 years of his, you know, recuperation and all of that. You know, they didn't have the expertise, and, you know, they've got, you know, a lot of different problems and stories, and, you know, they've got pastors to pay and buildings to build and, you know, this kind of stuff. And the other side of it was I was faced with a problem that, even though I was, you know, okay financially, there was no way I could have personally afforded to pay for all of my son's therapy. Mm. And as it was, even, you know, there was a significant chunk of money that the state of Missouri paid through a thing called the Missouri First Steps program that I will be, you know, grateful for till my last breath. That paid for, you know, probably 60, 70, 75% of the therapy, the critical therapy that my son had in his early years that allowed him to have the prospects for an amazing life like he does today. Without that government support, without that taxpayer, without that, you know, soaking the rich, if you will, in order to take care of people who didn't have the financial means to take care of themselves, my son, his prognosis would have just been incredibly different. So I was forced out of my little conservative political box by that event. And, you know, when you're pushed out of that kind of belief, it makes it easier to look more critically maybe at some of the other beliefs that you've just always held to be true without really closely evaluating them. I also got an MBA shortly thereafter, and again, new information about how economics actually works and the existence of weird things like monopsonies, which is the opposite of a monopoly, and this kind of thing. Again, as you broaden your worldview and find out more data that challenges your preconceived notions, things just kind of fall apart, and you're, again, able to apply that across multiple spheres.
It's funny how education tends to do that to a person.
You know what? My grandma was right.
Yeah. So your wife is still a Christian. How's that working out?
So, you know what? I'm not going to claim that there's no stress involved in our marriage over that, but I would say that one of the keystones of our marriage has always been, you know, the two of us are in lockstep. You know, my family has a history of divorce. Her family has a history of divorce. And so when I was a teenager, I did a lot of reading. I actually have a bachelor's degree in psychology in part because I want to understand how human relationships work so that I could avoid repeating the mistakes of my parents. And then, you know, the girl I married, you know, her parents had some of those things. So we really invested a lot in our marriage in counseling and therapy early on and weren't ashamed to ask for help and all this kind of fun stuff. So we built a really, really strong foundation before I came out as an atheist, and she was the first person to hear it. And of course, you know, she had seen my struggles, and we discussed this stuff along the way, so it wasn't a huge surprise to her when it eventually happened. But you know, today, you know, there's some, you know, just some weirdnesses, things like, you know, I don't go to church with the family on Sundays anymore. I told her I was willing to go and just to be part of the family, but you know, I reserve the right to comment after the service, and she decided it was easier for me not to be there than have to listen to me complain afterwards. Yeah. You know, and we just have this, you know, when we're talking with our kids, we have different goals as far as the religion stuff goes. I support my kids and whatever their religious, you know, inclinations are. And when they ask me questions, which I'm kind of the parent that tends to get the philosophical questions, you know, I answer them honestly, but then I also, you know, follow up and say, but this is how, you know, mommy would probably answer that question. And this is how, you know, other people would answer that question. And by the way, I did that as a believer as well. So, you know, we still, there are some tension based moments, but for the most part, we have a really great relationship. It's founded on really deep emotional bonds, and we've crafted for a number of years. That, I mean, they weathered having a kid with autism. They can weather, you know, me taking on a science based worldview. You know, no problem.
Well, that's great. Where does she stand along the belief spectrum? Is she kind of in the middle? Is she more liberal, or is she still pretty much very conservative where you used to be?
Yeah, so we actually evolved together on that too. Again, she has not stepped over the atheism line, and I'm not going to say the word yet, even though I'd love to. But she hasn't stepped over that line. But you know, as I was going through some of the, you know, the challenges to biblical issues, I mean, again, you start evaluating what the Bible says about slavery and homosexuality in context of a modern society. It looks ridiculous to any person who's actually willing to think through the issues. And someone who, you know, knows the scientific background. My wife has a master's in computer science and bachelor's in chemistry and biology. So, you know, she's extremely smart and knows that stuff. So today, you know, we both evolved away from fundamentalist Christianity. And for a long time, I was the more conservative of the two of us. She kind of stopped at, you know, what I would call a more liberal mindset. She still believes in God. She still believes in Jesus. But it's more the God is love kind of mentality, mm-hmm. as opposed to a strict biblical interpretation of God. So she's, I'd say if you're going to be a Christian, that's, or a religious person of any kind, that's probably the absolute best place you can land.
All right. Yeah, I'm really sympathizing with the kind of, I don't know, you say that there's a little bit of stress there, but I don't know. I think that would be very tough for me personally, and I'm glad that you've come to grips with that. That's quite an achievement. And certainly when you talk about building that foundation before this happened, that's a big part of it as well. So, you know, good for you. there.
Oh, yeah, no, I have no doubt. If this had happened in the first 3 years of our marriage, you know, I would either be a single man or married to someone different today.
Right.
The fact that it happened, you know, 15, 16 years into our marriage was a significant predictor of our success.
Right. So do you still have ties or involvements with the religious community? And if so, what are they?
You know, I really don't have a lot other than just, you know, I still have a lot of religious friends. But I'm not really involved in church activities. I don't really participate in, you know, religious sponsored, you know, charities and that kind of thing anymore. I'd say, and my daughter, we recently pulled out of, my last tie was, my daughter attended Christian school through her sophomore year, and it was a very fundamentalist Christian school. Her sophomore year was really kind of a critical turning point, because up until that point, you know, the anti-science stuff was fairly mild. And, you know, there are things that I appreciate still today about, you know, a focus on, you know, long-term thinking and good moral behavior, not because it offends God, but because it ends up making your life better when you're older. If you can have that kind of view. But when her sophomore year, she took a biology class. And, oh, my gosh, it was an absolute disaster.
When you say biology, you mean biology in quotes, right?
Yeah, very much so. Her biology class was just, you know, bad science and misapplications of scientific principles, and it was just, again, hideous. And then her biblical training classes, you know, as teens start to approach, you know, puberty and sexual activity and whatever, they really start to hammer this kind of stuff a lot harder and start to tackle issues like homosexuality and this kind of thing. And, you know, and my wife is in complete alignment with my views on all of that. You know, she claims it's because of Jesus, and I claim it's because of a thing called the Platinum Rule. Okay. But we are in lockstep on how ridiculous some of the stances of the school were. So that plus the fact that her Christian school didn't offer the kinds of advanced placement classes she needed for getting into a good computer science program after graduation, we pulled her out of that environment. So really, today, I've kind of cut all cords as far as my religious activities go.
And I take it you explain a lot of this in your book. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your book?
Sure. So the title of the book is That's Me in the Corner, Coming Out as an Atheist on Facebook. And what it is, it's actually a diary of a series of Facebook posts that I made starting at the beginning of this year. So the first one was on January 6th of 2014. Because I decided I was going to go public, because I'd been very public as an apologist about my challenges to atheists and non-believers. And so I thought it was fair that I be equally as open and honest about, hey, you know what, not only do I agree that you're right, but here's how I have processed all of the hang-ups that I thought I would have going into this. And I originally intended to, you know, write like a series of like six or eight, I don't remember the exact number, posts. They kind of, you know, lightly touched on issues like morality and Pascal's wager and biblical inerrancy and stuff like that. And also, it is an open invitation, I will fully admit, to believers to take a look how I built this worldview, how I came to my decisions, and challenge me on it. I get letters every so often, emails from people saying, hey, have you thought about blah, 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 blah? And then we have a dialogue, and so far no one has really knocked the horn anything. But I'm, again, the first person to admit, if there's any evidence, objective evidence whatsoever, for the existence of the supernatural, I'll change positions again, no problem. So just show me, give me something that I can hang my hat on to do that, and I'm on that bandwagon. So it also serves that purpose for me personally.
Yeah. Jason, let me give you a heads up. There's no such evidence.
I'm not holding my breath, though, but at the same time, I do want to at least maintain intellectual honesty like I hope everyone else, like I wish everyone else would.
Right. Trust me, if such evidence ever does arise, everybody will know about it. But until that point, we're solid with our beliefs. Well, Jason, this has been wonderful. I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with not only our listeners, but everybody else on the internet. I'm sure you're an inspiration to many people, and it's just a great story. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Bo. All right. Appreciate the opportunity.
Bye-bye. That was Mr. Jason Eden sharing his deconversion story with us. We talked a little bit about the God of the Gaps argument, and that's an interesting one because when you talk to believers, it's hard to understand the way they see things because they truly believe that this magical God exists, and it makes perfect sense to them that anything that doesn't fit under science or it's not within our knowledge, our grasp currently, well, it's just God. You know, God did it. And it makes a lot more sense to them than it makes to us. I don't know. I don't understand it, but apparently some people do. All right, if you have any feedback on this episode, we'd love to hear from you. Just send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or you could call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Folks, I want to thank you very much for listening to this podcast, and we'll see you next week on the Humanist Hour. Bye-bye, everybody.